Mm-hmm. How did it actually happen?
Well, looking back a long way, my mother was always very interested in public life and what women were doing. I mean, she didn't do anything herself at all, but she always was. And I joined, while I was still at school, the local school VAD. And when the First World War broke out, we were always having demonstrations of what our VAD did, and for some reason or other, I was always asked to stand out and let everybody question me. And then the VAD was connected with an organization where, now let me remember properly, where we both collected clothes, I think it was,
yes,
for refugees, etc., and where the branches of the Red Cross men,
yes,
who'd been trained to do the work that they ought to do, they used to come to Cambridge Hall before they went off to Europe in small groups to act as bearers of people who'd been wounded. And we had a very well-known man in the north of England called Colonel Palmer, who was the head of all that. And I really seemed to turn into his ADC in a way. Well then, we used to give the men a supper party at Cambridge Hall before they got on their train to go off.
Could I just interrupt you and ask you what Cambridge Hall is? It's a local assembly point,
yes,
is it?
Yes.
It's not a university assembly.
No. It was a big hall in Newcastle on Tyne.
I see, yes.
Well then, one night, when the men came, the supper party was all arranged, but Colonel Palmer never turned up. And I thought to myself, they must have somebody to wish them good luck and say something nice. And as in my young days, I had extremely good elocution lessons, I thought I'd better just get up and do the honors. And there was nobody else there to do them excepting me. And that was my first speech. And I remember that now very well. And so I sent...
Still quite unusual for a woman to give a speech, even at that time, wasn't it? I mean,
I think so, really,
just
yes.
Not just you, but any woman.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it seemed to be quite easy. I only had to say some nice words, and I always could get on with people very easily. And that was my first speech. And from that, oh yes, I remember one very funny story, because the university in Newcastle became the first a general hospital, and people, the troops were brought over from Belgium and Holland and all around there to that hospital. Then my cousin, who was also a member of the VAD, she just spent 2 years, I think, in Brussels learning French. I was never a linguist. And when these men came over from Belgium, she was asked to go to the hospital to interpret to the doctors. And I went along with her. Goodness knows why, because as I say, I was no linguist. And then I remember so well, of course they all spoke Flemish. So nobody could speak Flemish. So presumably the doctors just had to do the best they could. So that rather started me. And then I got to know a very distinguished, well-known coal owner who became Sir Cecil Cochrane, who was chairman of a great many very well-known colliery companies, and he was, curiously enough, a liberal. And he, during the war, became the liberal member for South Shields. And I, at that moment, became his secretary. And he interested me enormously, of course, in politics. And he then got into the House of Commons. So that rather launched me in politics, because I used to go to all his meetings and enjoyed it all immensely. And when our country became a protectionist country, he then became a conservative.
I see. Did he got the coupon in 1918, did he?
Well, no, he went in to Parliament, I think, about 1916, if I remember rightly.
Yes.
And then he decided, because he was a very remarkable and wonderful man in the north of England, he decided he'd gone into Parliament too late in life, because he really was a businessman. And so he then resigned from Parliament. And which I thought was very sad, but by that time I got interested in politics, and I started off in that way.
Did you connect yourself with the Newcastle Conservative Association or with local conservative politics?
I'm trying to remember, really. No, at that particular moment, the headquarters of the Conservative Party, which is always referred to as central office, came to the conclusion that they wanted some ordinary women, that is to say, not widows of not widows of distinguished men, or if I remember rightly, when a member of the House of Commons went into the Lords, where of course I am, which really makes me laugh a lot, the Conservative Party thought if they could have some people, ordinary women, who could fight elections, it would be a good thing. And while I was acting as private secretary to Cecil Cochrane, who was a, as I say, a very distinguished coal owner, I learnt a lot about coal. And to my amazement, because the north of England wasn't really very pro-woman at all, suddenly there were three women got involved in politics. Mabel Russell, who was an actress and the wife of Hilton Philipson, who was had overspent, or his agent had overspent, when he became the member for Berwick. So when he couldn't go on any longer, she offered herself. And of course, as an actress, she had a very good voice, she was very charming, and she fought and won. Then a very well-known woman in the North called Mrs. Middleton, who was also, I think, interested in public life, she suddenly was invited to stand for what was then called the old one-spec division. And then, to my amazement, they seemed to think that I represented an ordinary woman, but I could speak. I did know about coal, so I was then rushed off to fight Morpeth. And I fought, first of all, this is going a little bit ahead, you see, in 1924 I fought Bob Smiley, who was the president of the Miners' Federation, and then in 29 I fought Ebbie Edwards, who was the general secretary of the Miners' Federation, and there I was launched into politics in a big way.
Could I just interrupt you just briefly? One of the problems that women face between the wars is getting a good constituency.
Mm.
I mean, and Morpeth, I imagine, as an old liberal, lib-lab sort of constituency, would be a very bad constituency.
Oh, it was. I was.
Would it be fair to say it was a hopeless constituency?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm. But then the all the political parties always fight every seat, not because they think they can win, but because it keeps whoever is likely to win from going round helping other people. That's the sort of basis, you see. And so I had a frightful time. I mean, but fortunately, I could answer questions, and I didn't mind being barracked by the miners.
When you say you had a frightful time, that was what it was, was it?
Oh,
a lot,
yes,
of heckling and
barracking. Oh, terrible heckling. And but I didn't mind that a bit. I quite enjoyed it. Well then, I lived in a place called Gosport, which is a residential place, but it was, for some extraordinary reason, in the division of Wall's End, which was won by Margaret Bonfield, who was the first Labour woman cabinet minister. And for some quite extraordinary reason, Wall's End asked me if I'd like to fight Margaret Bonfield. And, you see, as it happened, I never went before a selection committee for any of the constituencies that I fought. I was always asked if I'd stand, and I was delighted to be asked for my own division. I was very proud of that. Well, then, of course, the 31 election arrived, and I found myself in Parliament as Conservative Member of Parliament for Wall's End.
Presumably it had been a fairly marginal constituency before then.
No, not marginal at all.
And it was Labour, was it?
Oh, absolutely.
Was it really?
Yes.
So 1931 really changed the whole complexion of the constituency in a way. I mean,
well, yes.
It became a safe... Well, it didn't... Perhaps you changed it.
It didn't become safe. because when the 1935 election turned up, everybody, that's to say Central Office and all the great Conservative organisation, they all wrote me off and said I was bound to lose. Well, for some quite extraordinary reason, I happened to win. So that
was against Margaret Bonfield again, was it?
Against Margaret Bonfield again. Mm. At one time, Stafford Cripps was the member for Wall's End, you see. It was a very powerful Labour seat, really. And so I suddenly found myself in Parliament.
I think you'll probably be unduly modest, because you must have revealed both to the Conservative Party and to the constituents certain qualities which were politically useful. I mean, you could deal with interruption.
I always got on very well with people. And as I say, I wouldn't have done so well if I hadn't known a lot about coal. That's why even today I'm very interested in the miners, and maddening though they are, even in the House of Lords, I get up and remind my own party that we had to stop miners recruiting in two world wars. And I liked them awfully, though they gave me a frightful time. They once tried to drown me, and they threw pen knives at me and chairs at me. And not so very long ago, the BBC said they would do my life, you see. And whoever was doing it wanted to take me out to Ashington, which was one of the big mining areas in the old division of Morpeth, you see. And the general manager there said, oh, you can't bring her out. They're bound to kidnap her. And the BBC man said, good gracious, they won't kidnap her. So we went out, and I met the men coming off the 4:30 a.m. shift. And of course, they all know me, and they laughed and waved as they came off, though, of course, they were a much younger generation again. And I said, I've just got one thing to say to you. And I said, I remember the day when you threw chairs at me in a great ballroom in Ashington. You threw chairs at me and you dropped off the rafters on top of me on the platform. And I said, I'm thrilled to know that that frightful hall has been burnt down. And they roared with laughter, and I roared with laughter, and we waved each other goodbye. And there I was, and that's how I got into politics, as you asked me that question.
Would it be fair to say that the women's movement, or the feminist movement, nowhere comes into that picture at all? That you did it entirely on your own personality, your own connection.
Yes, it was nothing to do with well, at that time I don't suppose I even knew about women's organisations really. Mm. But if I can just do one jump ahead, which might amuse you, I went to the first. The Naval Review in 35 for the Silver Jubilee of King George V and Queen Mary. And I was in the House of Commons, of course, And as I always loved the Navy, and of course Wall's End was a very big shipbuilding area, so I was always interested in that, I decided I'd like to go. And I was the only woman member of Parliament who wanted to go. So I went down, and I think we went on a cruiser, and when I got there, the captain said, "I'm most awfully sorry." By that time, of course, I was always known just as Irene Ward. "I'm awfully sorry," he said, "but I can't allow you on deck, because if the king saw a woman on one of his cruisers, he'd be extremely angry." So I had no fun. I wasn't allowed to be on deck. I was incarcerated in a cabin looking through a porthole. And I thought to myself, this Naval Review, I thought, really, in those days, the change, when you think that, as I hope, Margaret Thatcher will be the first conservative woman prime minister, I thought, really, how life's changed.
Could I ask you a little bit about your parents? I mean, you said you went to a school where you were taught elocution.
Yes.
Was that just a routine thing for a girl at that time of your social position, or was it? Were they interested in politics, your parents? Did they want you to?
No, my father died when I was very young, you see. There was only my mother and myself. My father was an architect. My father came from a very large family. My grandmother had 11 children, 7 sons and 4 daughters, and my father was the only one who left the North and came to London as an architect. He was very artistic, he was very creative, and though I am an Anglican, but he went out with my mother to see Santa Sophia in Turkey then, yes. And he designed some of the mosaics in Westminster Cathedral.
Did he really?
Mm.
Because it was just being built then, wasn't it?
Yes.
In the late
90s. Yes.
Yeah.
And, but, now why did I
know? So really it all starts up in the First World War, your
yes.
politics. It's nothing
yes.
to do with preparation by
no, 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 nothing like that.
Was but your mother a suffragette or suffragist?
No, not at all.
Mm.
I think she was very interested in, I think she was more interested in the suffragettes perhaps than I was. But you see, she was really a very remarkable woman, because as I say, my father died very young. We really had practically no money. But because my father hadn't lived long enough really to create any or make any. But she always took me, even though we had to sit in the gallery, to see the greatest people whenever they came north. For instance, I remember being taken to see Pavlova. I remember being taken to hear Tetrazzini, to hear Melba. And I remember she took me to hear Mrs. Pankhurst. But, she always thought that it was right that one should try and hear the great people in the in that world, you see.
So it wasn't as a women's campaigner, it was as a great woman. Really.
Yes, mm. yes. Mm. And but I think she was interested in the suffragettes, but probably because she was interested in Mrs. Pankhurst, because she was, you know, such a leading woman and such a leading individual in that sphere.
Could you tell me what it was like as a woman standing in 1924? Because you were quite early among the women candidates, weren't you? I mean, did people say, oh, how queer, having a woman, let alone in Morpeth? I mean, was there that sort of reaction at all?
No, I don't think so. I can remember being extremely annoyed with... I better not mention the paper's name, but I remember a reporter coming up, and he wrote about Mabel Russell, Mrs. Middleton, and me, and of course said how wonderful it was because Mabel Russell was a very remarkable actress. And he then wrote about Mrs. Middleton because she was so very well known in the North. And then he wrote about me, and all he had to say was I was a girl with a pretty face. And that annoyed me intensely at that time.
It wouldn't have
annoyed me so much now. But then I thought, oh, is that all that a reporter can say about me? But you see, as there were three women in the North fighting that election, I don't think that it occurred to people that it was very odd, because it seemed quite natural.
So all the barracking you got from the miners was just because you were a Conservative candidate?
Yes,
not because
that's
you're
right.
A woman
no,
before.
No, that yeah. Because I was a Conservative candidate.
You think they would have had a certain amount of chivalry, actually, in view of
Well, I've always said that, and it's true, that really sometimes they gave me a frightful time, and I was very often rescued by them as well. You see, they had the two sides. And I used to have jokes too. I remember going to one meeting where the miners were determined that they wouldn't let me speak. Well, before I went, I put on about six coats. And when they got more than I could bear, I would say, let's have a rest, and I shall take off a coat. And I would then take off a coat and sit down for a bit. Then I'd start again, and then the same thing happened. I'd say, oh, well, let's have a rest. I'll take off another coat. And in the end, I made them laugh, you see, because they've got a great sense of humour, the miners. And as I say, when they decided that we had to stop recruiting in the First World War, the army adored having miners in their regiments because they were courageous, they were creative, and
good sports.
And good sports. And and so that, in a way, I suppose, if I say this rather immodestly, I think they rather enjoyed my reaction to them. And never minded being heckled. I enjoyed it because I knew the answers.
What about Bob Smiley, actually? I mean, how was his attitude to you? Did you just keep your distance from each other in 1934?
Well, Bob Smiley... Well, I always found that people like Bob Smiley were awfully nice whenever I met them, because they knew perfectly well that they were going to win and I was going to lose. If it had been the other way round, I don't suppose they'd have been as nice.
And the same with Ebbie Edwards in 29?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Ebbie Edwards in 29, yes. I didn't like Ebbie Edwards as well as I liked Bob Smiley. But...
Bob Smiley was a major... Well, of course, you were fighting major figures in the...
Oh, major figures, yes.
I mean,
well,
Margaret Bonfield, of course.
Yes, major figures, really, all the time,
yeah.
Actually.
Could we move on to 1931 and your contest with Margaret Bonfield?
Yes.
I mean, there you've got two women candidates fighting each other. Did that seem to you rather unpleasant in a way? I mean...
Well, Margaret Bonfield was... very patronising. Well, she thought she would win, you see, so she was very patronising. She used to ring up my agent and ask if she could give me a lift to a meeting. I said, good gracious, no. But the only thing that I remember doing extremely badly, we were both invited to go and kick off at a football match. And as nobody had ever warned me how to kick a football, I did do it extremely badly. She probably had been warned how to kick a football, so she did it better than I did.
But it was, must have been quite a novelty, having two women candidates.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And, but on the other hand, you see, in the 31 election, in War's End, I'm always telling them this because there were, in the industrial part of War's End, which of course was mining, shipbuilding, engineering, there were 84% of the employable population unemployed. Mm. Now that, I've never forgotten. And I really think that to have the miners, a whole lot of them must have voted for me because I got in, you see. And I remember one miner who the first time he was offered the dole, he was so upset, he went home and smashed up all his furniture. Now, psychologically, I've never understood that. But...
it's a symbol of loss of respectability.
Yes,
in a way.
I really never forgot what it was like for people. 84%. And in the North, I mean, they were very proud workmen. And as I say, I think on the whole, I scored a little bit being younger and... you know, but Margaret Bonfield was jolly patronising.
What sort of person was she, actually? I mean, did you have much contact with her apart from just that rather limited election contact?
No, not really, because she always thought she would win. Mm. And I learnt a lot, really, because in War's End, we counted in one room, in one hall, and then we had to walk down the lane and go into the council chamber and appear on a balcony. And I remember so well going down an absolutely ragged, what one would call a beggar, calling out, "Who's won?" And my people, of course, called out, "Irene." And he said, "Thank God." And I thought to myself, I must never let those kind of people down. I thought it was a most wonderful... Oh, it made me feel that I must work for dealing with unemployment, which I always tried to do, and also looking after people like that who were so courageous when I thought all that I'd had in life, really, and to think that he would be backing me, I thought was very remarkable.
So did you join that group of rather progressive conservatives really running, associating with Harold Macmillan and so on?
Yeah. Oh, yes, indeed.
Did you?
Oh, yes, indeed. I still consider myself a very left-wing Tory, and I think that from the point of view of the Conservative Party, Harold, because in those days the industrialists, most of them, disliked politicians, and Harold Macmillan, with a pretty tough seat himself at Stockton, he saw that you had to get the industrialists and the Conservative members together. And, oh yes, I was a great supporter of Harold. And I think that having him in an area like the north of England was a most wonderful thing, because you could always talk to him, and he was a very remarkable man. And
he was rather on a limb, of course, at that time, wasn't he?
Oh,
he
yes.
He wasn't a mainline conservative.
No, not at all. Mm. And I think I learned a lot from him, because I've never thought that I'm a sort of real Tory, if you know what I mean. I am a Tory because I believe in the policy, but I also think that one's got to try to make one's policy really deal with the problems that arose in the area that I represented.
Could I just ask you about the London Society? I mean, how were you actually, if I may ask you, living up till the time you got into the House of Commons? I mean, how were you supporting yourself? Were you simply a sort of daughter at home?
Yes, excepting that I, as I say, was secretary to Cecil Cochrane.
But that carried on all the way through.
And that carried on all the way through. And at one time, he and his wife wanted to adopt me, because they had no children, you see. So, but then I couldn't do that from the point of view of my mother. And so, my mother, of course, had some money, and my uncles were very helpful. One of the things that I did turn out to be, I was a very good ballroom dancer. I was both taught elocution and ballroom dancing. I was regarded as, again rather immodestly, as the best ballroom dancer in the North. And
you were a social asset, really.
And I used to go and dance with the miners quite often. I got on better with them doing that than arguing politics.
So you weren't presumably based in London then at all.
No.
You were all based in Newcastle.
All based.
I was really wondering how you ever made contact with the London Society. I mean, presumably only after you became an MP.
That's right. Mm. Because, I mean, I'm not a woman's lib, but I was very proud. There were quite a lot of people that I came across. And then during the last war, we formed the Woman Power Committee.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about
of
that.
Which I was chairman, you see.
Did you, when you got to Parliament in 1931, did Lady Astor make a beeline for you and sort of help you along into the house?
Well, she couldn't have been kinder. She really couldn't have been kinder. She was a very, very kind and delightful woman, but she was really no asset politically to the Tory party. But she was.
But she resembles you in two ways. First of all, she's a progressive conservative,
yes,
isn't she? And secondly, she's a woman conservative MP.
Yes.
And you'd think that you would probably have quite a lot in common.
Oh, we had. Oh, we had.
And she did actually take responsibility to sort of initiate you, did she, into the House of Commons a bit?
No. Oh, no. I mean, I can't even now remember who. Oh, well, of course, as I got in at an election, I didn't have to be specially introduced.
No, I really meant sort of being shown the ropes and things like that. I mean,
oh, well,
she was very good like that with other MPs.
Oh, yes, she was. She was awfully good. I remember they always laugh now because I always wear a hat, and I think that really was because Nancy always wore a hat, so I always wore a hat, but also because my hair is so fine that I always like to look tidy.
Did you ever actually go to any of her receptions?
Oh, yes, I did, and I used to go and stay with her at Clifton quite often. And she always insisted that I ought to dress in black. And in those days, I did, of course.
Well, because it suited you, you mean? She thought.
No, because that she always dressed in black.
I see. Mm.
And she was awfully good and awfully kind, and I know maddening though she was in lots of ways, because one of my Lord friends were reminding me the other day, you see, she used to suddenly, she'd sit in the front row on the Conservative side and she'd put in artificial teeth and then bow to the Labour opposition. Oh, is she? I mean, she's got a great sense of humour, which was really very nice.
I've only read parliamentary debates when she participates, and it seems to me she's always interrupting.
Oh, yes. She was.
To an unmannerly degree, actually. She was. I don't know whether you feel that.
Oh, yes. I don't think she did any good politically from that point of view. I mean, if I said to her, oh dear, I'm having such trouble with, say, one of our Conservative ministers, she would say, I'll just ring him up and tell him what he ought to do. Well, you can imagine, ministers don't like that sort of thing. And she could have done a great deal more politically.
What was she doing in these receptions that she held in St. James's Place, wasn't it, I think?
Yes.
What were they important, do you think?
I remember one very funny one. This was just when we were trying to prevent the outbreak of the Second World War. And the executive, I suppose, of the League of Nations were coming over from wherever they were meeting in Geneva. And she was asked, I mean, the Conservative Party used her, both her money and her power of entertaining. And I remember she was told she must give a dinner party for them. So she said, oh yes, she would. And I was asked to the dinner party, and she had out all her gold plate and everything. And then during dinner, she went round and whispered to all of us, after dinner, we're going to play musical chairs, and you must let the Germans win. By that time, she was probably entertaining Ribbentrop and, you know, trying to put them off going to war. And she said, we must play musical chairs and must let the Germans win. Well, if you can think of anything more ridiculous than all these very distinguished people rushing round playing musical chairs and letting the Germans win.
What people have told me about her is that she did actually bring women politicians and women reformers and so on together.
She was very pro. She was very pro-woman, of course. And
so at these gatherings you'd meet useful other women?
I remember going to one lunch party which she was giving for Bernard Shaw, to whom she was very devoted, and suddenly she banged the table and said, quiet, Mr. Shaw wishes to speak. I was devoted to her, really. And
Did you then join the junior council once you'd become an MP, when you got to London, so to speak? Is that the connection, or has it actually faded out of your memory now?
Well, it's really faded out of my memory. But we had actually Quinton Hailsham's aunt, who was married, I think, to a South African, Ethel Wood, who lived up in Little Venice. She became the secretary of our Woman Power Committee. She was very pro-woman. And she really interested me. I became much more interested in the Fawcett Society and everything, because I wanted women to play their full part with the knowledge that they were able to give, because by that time there was another woman, Caroline Hazlitt.
Oh, yes, the engineer.
Yes. Now, she did. I was a great supporter of hers because she wanted, and rightly, wanted women to really qualify in industrial matters.
Because, of course, you would have a connection with her via Lady Parsons, wouldn't you?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I've forgotten all about Lady Parsons.
And as the Women's Electrical Association.
That's right. Yes. Mm. Oh, yes. Oh, I fully supported the efforts of women to become really qualified, that they could help with their qualifications.
So really, in a sense, would it be fair to say you're gearing into the women's movement only really about 1940 or so? Mm-hmm. That's really where mm-hmm. you come
yes.
into that movement.
Yes, yes. And then, as I say, I was... I was a great traveller. I was sent out to China during the war to interpret, if you can believe it, the war effort of the Chinese.
Incidentally, while I think of it, did you presumably remember Nora Balls, do you?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Her,
yes.
Living in her Bamborough car.
Yes, that's right. Incredible. Oh, yes.
She was presumably one of your constituency workers, was she? Or she presumably helped you in...
Oh, she did. Oh, yes, she did. But she wasn't really interested in the political battle.
No.
Because, you see, I was always interested in the political battle. I was interested to find out if I could, and I couldn't always, which is quite right, really, what political views people had. And, Nora Balls was a great influence in the women's world.
I met her, actually, about 6 months ago. I went to see her.
Oh, yes. Bamborough's lovely.
Oh, marvellous. But could you just tell me how you got involved with this woman power thing then? I mean, how did it develop, really? How did you get involved?
I'm trying to remember why we formed the Woman Power Committee. Well...
We were simply the compensation arrangements, wasn't it, for war injury?
That was... sometimes people say that... nobody ever makes a speech in either the Commons or the Lords which has any effect. But one woman, Mavis Tate, who really made a brilliant speech which did have an effect, because women drivers used to drive down into the city when the bombs were falling, and people were going round, trying to help where the bombs had fallen and awful things had happened. And the bombs were still falling, and the women driving the cars had to sit and wait until whoever they were driving came back. And they could quite easily have been bombed and very badly injured. And we were extremely annoyed that we never could get equal pay for them. Now, Mavis Tate made an absolutely brilliant speech in the Commons, and that did change the attitude of the government, and they were granted equal pay.
Did she preside over the Woman Power Committee at first?
No, I did. No, it was always, yes. Because I had some of the, I think some of them are still alive, some of the trains union women. Dorothy Elliott, she was on that committee. And no, the Woman Power Committee, I think, was... I can't really quite remember why we formed it. But
yeah, it's really just to get women of all parties together to look after the interests.
That's
of women
right.
In the war.
That's right. Yes, you're quite right. That was what it was.
Because the war presents all sorts of opportunities and challenges, doesn't it?
And
to women as such.
And I was always chairman of that. And Ethel Wood, who, as I say, was Quinton Hailsham's aunt, was the honorary secretary. She wrote a book called Mainly for Men, if I remember
rightly. Did she really? Didn't she also write The Pilgrimage of Peshawar?
Yes, she was very religious.
Yes.
And...
But presumably then, as soon as you're involved in the woman power business, you're then involved with the Fawcett Society.
That's right.
I mean, presumably...
Yes.
They automatically...
And I did, of course, admire immensely that wonderful library that they'd... And then my great friend was Thelma Kasdet Keir, who defeated the government on
equal pay.
Yes. She was very courageous, because she hated having to vote against Winston, but she did it very bravely. And it had a great success.
Did Baldwin actually take an interest in you as a woman candidate?
Yes, yes. He really, I think, was my favourite Prime Minister. Yes, Thelma and I went and stayed with the Baldwins during the last war.
Did you really?
Mm. Oh, yes, he was very progressive.
Well, that's very interesting, because I have to defend him against all my undergraduate pupils, because they all say, you know, he did nothing.
That was absolutely untrue. Because you could always... Well, you see, in the House of Commons, whenever the House of Commons got rowdy, the chief whip always sent for Baldwin, and he could calm the House in a very remarkable way. He really was. And he did mind about people. You could always get him to support you in what I called progressive Toryism. And... But he was so modest. I mean, I thought he was a most remarkable man. And
because, of course, he did introduce, or he was Prime Minister when equal franchise was introduced in 1928.
Yes.
And well, I wondered whether he was interested in women conservative candidates, you know, whether he sort of jollied them along and helped them.
Yes, certainly he did.
Did he? Yes.
Oh, very much so. And you see, I've always thought, from the conservative point of view, we had far too much of Neville Chamberlain. I always thought that Neville Chamberlain, the unfortunate thing for him was, I didn't get on with him at all. I think that he was very concerned with Horace Wilson, was that the man's name?
That's right, the civil service.
Yes, well, I thought they had the same type of brain, and I thought it was very unfortunate. And I thought the Conservative Party, I thought the Birmingham played much too much of a part. When I thought of all our problems, and Birmingham never had any real industrial problems like we had in my part of the world. And, I was devoted to Baldwin.
As a woman MP, did you make a lot of use of the Fawcett Library?
No, not really, because... I don't really... when I wanted to make a speech, I made a speech on things I felt I knew about.
You didn't have to do much looking
no,
up and things
no,
like that?
No, no.
Of course, the Women's Service Library, as it was then, was designed, rather, wasn't it, as a sort of service for women MPs?
That's right.
In a way.
Yes.
But you didn't use it yourself.
I didn't really need to, because I had plenty of people to advise me on the things I was interested in, and I was very keen when we, I'm trying to think what the relationship was, bringing new industries. You see, in the mining world, and I get very annoyed with it even today, I was very annoyed with the new bill that the Labour Party brought in yesterday in the Lords. Northumberland and Durham were early coal fields.
Oh, yes.
And, I mean, I used to go, I had to crawl on my tummy up to the coal face. Now, I was also connected with Bolsover, which, of course, well, my friend Cecil Cochran was chairman of Bolsover for years. He was very progressive. And they had deep seams, and the men could go on a little railway up to the coal face. And you see, nobody, as far as I can make out, in, well, I should think probably in either a Conservative government or a Labour government, realised the difference between an early developed coal field and an up-to-date developed coal field. And when I think of all the left-wing people now, when I listen to that man Dennis Skinner talking about the Bolsover that I used to know.
Because in a way, you've always been a Northumberland person battling away for Northumberland
people right.
in London, haven't you?
Yes.
And that's been one of your
the
roles.
The northern area, yes. Northumberland and Durham, yes. Yes. Yes.
Because one of the things you're known for is being a very good constituency MP.
Yes.
So you must have always felt, in some ways, a bit separate from the sort of established Conservative
circles. Oh, yes.
Circle.
Well, I say today, devoted, I'm very devoted, both to Margaret Thatcher and to Ted. You see, I don't want, if ever we produce a manifesto, I don't want it built entirely on safe Conservative seats.
Yeah, absolutely right.
You
I
see?
Mean, there's more need for progressive Conservatives
yes.
now than at any time.
Yes, that's absolutely. And you see, if the safe Conservative seats have, you know, 1,000 unemployed, well, you can take action to help them. But when you have the kind of unemployment that we've had in my part of the world, it's very difficult.
Could I just ask you about two personalities?
Yes, we mustn't be too much longer. Yes.
Ray and Pippa Strachey. Did you come across either of them?
Yes, I remember Ray Strachey. Yes.
How did you meet them then? In what context, really?
They, if I remember rightly, were great friends. I think she was a great friend of Nancy Astor's.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, Ray Strachey, she was her secretary.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Mm. And,
what sort of person was she, actually?
Well, she was, you see, I've always believed in work and fun. Now, I don't really know that I would ever have thought she might, of course. Ray Strachey might have liked fun. I don't know, but I certainly always liked work and fun. And I still like work and fun.
Your point is that you must enjoy your work and have a sense
of
fun about it.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
And do you feel she was like that as well, or was she more serious, or more earnest?
Do you mean...
Ray Strachey?
Oh, she was more earnest. I mean, well, she would... you know, I would... Oh, love to go out and dance, and I don't really know whether she ever did.
No, did she? That wasn't her line at all.
No, it wasn't her line at all. I had a one of my friends who was blinded in the First World War. He was a wonderful mountaineer. He would go climbing. Of course, he had to have masses of guides. He really couldn't see. And if you went dancing with him, which I very often did in those days, we used to love going to Hungary, his ability, even though he was blind, when we'd finished dancing, he would stop absolutely dead at the table at which we were sitting. I mean, it was the most extraordinary. I always enjoyed.
So in a way, that, I suppose, distances you a bit from the women's movement in that they all are all rather earnest, aren't they?
They are very earnest and probably achieve much more in their field. But I wouldn't say that.
I mean, one of the things, that the obstacles women have to face in politics, I would have thought, between the wars, is that they're labelled with the suffragettes.
Yes.
And you presumably get away from that a bit.
Oh, yes.
By having a sense of fun.
Oh, yes, I used to adore that. And
what about Pippa? Did you come across her at all? Pippa Strachey?
No, I don't think I did.
She was a very quiet, sort of rather bird-like Strachey, sister of Little
No,
Strachey.
I don't think I knew her. Mm. I don't remember her at all.
Mm.
But
the junior council, I suppose, wasn't important to you then, really. Of the Fawcett Society or the London Society.
Well, I think if you put it this way, what I really rather liked doing was, if anybody asked me to help them, whatever sphere it was in, whether it was the Fawcett Society or women who saw where help was needed to help women to qualify, I would always help them. But that didn't destroy my enjoyment of fun.
Splendid, I'm very glad to hear it. On this Woman Power Committee, though, what were the problems, really, that you had to face? I mean, partly just getting women coordinated from different parties.
Well, getting the equal pay where we thought it was. You see, that movement really did a great deal to bring equal pay about.
How, actually? I mean,
well, because we always were having deputations, and as I say, when I went out to China, my friend Thelma became the chairman of the Woman Power Committee, and I mean, nothing could have been braver than when she voted against Winston, because she wasn't nearly she didn't have the problems that I had in the North. And you see, the day that she voted against Winston on that for equal pay, that I just heard that my mother had been killed in a road accident, so I wasn't there to vote. Otherwise, I would certainly have voted with her. But
this committee had a number of trade unionists on it.
Oh, yes, they had.
And,
yes.
Politicians all
yes.
together.
Yes.
What, once a month, once a week?
We used to meet once a month.
Yes. And what to do, actually?
Well, to discuss where we ought to try to exercise power. Because, at that time, I think, not consciously, but at that time, I think men didn't. Men rather wanted to keep women as women who would be friendly and happy and make life more pleasant for them in lots of ways, without realizing that we felt we had to. You see, I took a great interest in my own way in special operations executive.
Did you really?
Oh, yes, indeed. And I did quite a lot on that.
Of course, one of the troubles that you have to fight against is not being taken seriously.
That's right.
Women, isn't it? I mean, they just treat you as
yes.
people who, you know, you indulge,
yes.
perhaps, but
yes.
who really are, when it really comes to the crunch, worth listening to.
But You see, I knew a lot of people in special operations, etc. And, oh yes, indeed I did. And, you see, one of my regrets is, and I think it's fair to say this, Winston didn't really like women members at all.
That's very interesting. Do tell me what makes you think that.
Well, I know he didn't. I don't really think... I don't think he ever spoke to me. And, mind you, I think he'd had a terrible time with Nancy Astor, and he just didn't like... He liked women, but he liked women in their proper place. And I was very pleased when the instructions went out to build up Special Operations Executive, because I saw the original cabinet paper, because I wrote my book on Fanny and Victor, because they used the Fannies, you see. And I was absolutely delighted when the original cabinet instruction, which a friend of mine managed to get hold of for me, Winston said, and it was the first time I ever knew him say, that Special Operations Executive were to use both men and women. Because he thought that women could move among the enemy without being recognized as easily as men would be recognized. And I thought, ha, for the first time, Winston has seen that there's a part that women can play, which was a very dangerous part, and it was the first time he really acknowledged that women could be useful in that kind of sphere.
Because he didn't like Dame Florence Horsford, did he? I mean, I don't know where I read this, but she felt that he didn't. I think he swore or something, and then.
Florence
expected her to be embarrassed.
Yes,
or something, I don't know.
Florence didn't really like me either.
And I suppose he imagined she was a spinster who somehow, easily shocked by male behaviour.
Yes.
But there was an incident. You said that Lady Astor, he had given him a rough time. How do you mean it?
Oh, well, because she was always... she put in these false teeth she really did. And he couldn't take that. He wasn't that type of man. I mean, he wouldn't be... she used to give him an awful time in the House of Commons.
You mean as Prime Minister?
Yes.
I understand, yes.
Before he became Prime Minister. And, you see, I have all sorts of... for instance, there was great criticism. I used this for something the other day. When Alan Brooke wrote his great book...
Turn of the Tide.
That's it.
Yes.
Well, now, a lot of people criticised him, but I didn't, because if he hadn't written that book, people would have been inclined to think that everything during the war was done by Winston. I mean, Winston, of course, is at the top, but he had an immense amount of creative work done by people like those who were mentioned by Alan Brooke in his book, you see. And
because there was an incident, I think, in the biography of Lady Astor where she knew that he didn't like her,
mm-hmm.
and she once said why or something, and he said, "Well, I feel Lady Astor as though, Nancy, as though I'd been caught in the bathroom
loading
my sponge."
That's right.
It's simply a male club attitude, really.
Yes. And that was really the...
Now, she sounds really rather a pain in some ways.
Well, she was, it, like a lot of people, if any of the staff were ill, Nancy would go to see them.
The House of Commons staff?
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, yes, she would go and see them, and she'd be absolutely marvellous. And
just not a good advertisement for women MPs, particularly.
That's right. But, I mean, as an individual, she was terribly kind. And
have you read Rose Harrison, actually?
Yes, I have. Oh, yes, I have. Yes, now, somebody, what I call a brother in your category, wrote the other day and asked me if I would... I've forgotten who it was. They wanted the BBC to have another programme so that that what she said could be not obliterated, but dealt with. Because I can't believe that Nancy was all that Rose said. But I mean, she could let out at you if she wanted to.
Well, I'm worried about two things. First of all, your speech this afternoon, yes. And secondly, your lunch.
Well, I think we'd better come. I've got the table.